Chapter 1. Couldn't keep it to myself. Removing my mask. When the Detroit Rebellion, also known as the 12th Street Riot, broke out in July of 1967, the turmoil woke me out of my academic world. I could no longer continue quietly teaching white students at Adrian College, Michigan, about Karl Barth, Paul Tillich, and other European theologians when black people were dying in the streets of Detroit, Newark, and the back roads of Mississippi and Alabama. I had to do something. But I wasn't a civil rights leader like Martin Luther King Jr. or an artist like James Baldwin, who was spurred in his writing when he saw the searing image of a black girl, Dorothy Counts, surrounded by hateful whites as she attempted to integrate a white school in Charlotte, North Carolina, September 1957. I was a theologian, asking, what, if anything, is theology worth in the black struggle in America? Theology was my trade, all I had to show for nearly 30 years of living. I had a Ph.D. in systematic theology, but I didn't know how to use it in the fight for justice since nothing I'd read spoke about what black people were going through. I had no models to follow. The few Negroes who had studied theology imitated white theologians, as I'd done while writing a doctoral dissertation on the Swiss theologian Karl Barth. The Detroit Rebellion deeply troubled me and revolutionized my way of thinking. I could no longer write the same way, following the lead of Europeans and white Americans. I had to find a new way of talking about God that was accountable to black people and their fight for justice. I was the only Negro professor at a white college in a Midwestern city of about 25,000 people, which included, as far as I could tell, no more than 50 Negroes, including me. I had gone to Adrian, a Negro, during the summer of 1966, and I had tried my best to fit in. Lester B. Scherer, a friend and classmate at Garrett Theological Seminary, now Garrett Evangelical, and Northwestern University, had recommended me, and I didn't want to disappoint him. He had taken a risk, assuring colleagues who'd never had a Negro on their faculty that I was no troublemaker or angry black militant, and thus would make an excellent hire. Although Stokely Carmichael's proclamation of black power was the most talked about subject in the news, I did not talk about race with my neighbors. I kept my cool, trying to be a good Negro. I had a wife and a 4-year-old son, and I didn't want to make our social life impossible. I didn't even talk about race with my progressive colleagues at the college. We talked about our classes in religion, literature, and history, limiting our talk of justice to the escalating war in Vietnam. We marched against the war, incurring strong opposition from the president of the college, a Goldwater Republican, whose son was killed in Vietnam. I couldn't separate the killing of colored people in Vietnam from Negroes in America's cities, a connection Martin Luther King Jr. had made in his great Beyond Vietnam address at Riverside Church in New York on April 4, 1967. But I saw no way of articulating that connection without, like King, expressing deep anger about global racism, thereby threatening relations with my white colleagues. I was also silent about racial issues at the First United Methodist Church I attended. I knew that any talk about racism would be too controversial for white Republican Christians who'd voted for Barry Goldwater and who were eager to show me, with their smiles and general friendliness, that they were nice people with no prejudice against Negroes. In turn, I wanted to show them that I was a Christian Negro with good manners and no resentment against white people. I quietly blended in, participating as a leader in worship and taking young people on weekend retreats for Bible study and play. Of course, I had learned as a child to wear a mask, a disguise I had perfected by the time I moved to Adrian. "We wear the mask that grins and lies," wrote the great Negro poet Paul Laurence Dunbar in a poem I began reciting in grade school. Those words spoke to the experience of Negroes in Arkansas and the South generally, who took great risks in disagreeing with whites. When a Negro expressed an opinion that differed from a white person, the typical response was, "Are you calling me a liar, boy?" No black person would dare contradict a white man or woman, or even a child. In their world, white was always right. Knowing that, we had to disguise our true selves in order to keep a job, stay out of jail, or even stay alive. Got one mind for white folks to see, another for what I know is me. So went a well-known Negro folk song that I often